"Where would I live?" I asked, and he smiled. "With me." "Don't lie," I said, but he looked out at the surf. "I want you to come," he said seriously. He asked me 3 times. I counted, I know. That summer, my brother announced that he was going to dedicate his life to designing role-playing games, and my mother was trying to keep a second job for the first time since her operation. It wasn't working out. She was coming home exhausted, and since I wasn't helping, nothing around the house was getting done. Some weekends, my tía Rubelka would help out with the cooking and cleaning and would lecture us both, but she had her own family to watch after, so most of the time we were on our own. "Come," he said on the phone. And then in August, Karen left for Slippery Rock. She had graduated from high school a year early. "If I don't see Patterson again, it will be too soon," she said before she left. That was the September I cut school 6 times in my first 2 weeks. I just couldn't do school anymore. Something inside wouldn't let me. It didn't help that I was reading The Fountainhead and had decided that I was Dominique and Aldo was Rourke. I'm sure I could have stayed that way forever, too scared to jump. But finally, what we'd all been waiting for happened. My mother announced at dinner, quietly, "I want you both to listen to me. The doctor is running more tests on me." Oscar looked like he was going to cry. He put his head down. And my reaction? I looked at her and said, "Could you please pass the salt?" These days I don't blame her for smacking me across my face. But right then, it was all I needed. We jumped on each other, and the table fell, and the sancocho spilled all over the floor, and Oscar just stood in the corner bellowing, "Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!" "Hija de tu maldita madre," she shrieked. And I said, "This time I hope you die from it." For a couple of days the house was a war zone, and then on Friday she let me out of my room, and I was allowed to sit next to her on the sofa and watch novelas with her. She was waiting for her blood work to come back, but you would never have known her life was in the balance. She watched the TV like it was the only thing that mattered, and whenever one of the characters did something underhanded, she would start waving her arms. "Someone has to stop her! Can't they see what that puta is up to?" "I hate you," I said very quietly, but she didn't hear. "Go get me some water," she said. "Put an ice cube in it." That was the last thing I did for her. The next morning, I was on the bus bound for the shore. 1 bag, $200 in tips, Tio Rudolfo's old knife. I was so scared. I couldn't stop shaking. The whole ride down, I was expecting the sky to split open and my mother to reach down and shake me. But it didn't happen. Nobody but the man across the aisle noticed me. "You're really beautiful," he said, like a girl I once knew. I didn't write them a note. That's how much I hated them. Her. That night, while we lay in Aldo's sweltering, kitty-litter-infested room, I told him, "I want you to do it to me." He started unbuttoning my pants. "Are you sure?" "Definitely," I said grimly. He had a long, thin dick that hurt like hell. But the whole time I just said, "Oh, yes, Aldo, yes," because that was what I imagined you were supposed to say while you were losing your virginity to some boy you thought you loved. It was like the stupidest thing I ever did. I was miserable and so bored. But of course I wouldn't admit it. I had run away, so I was happy, happy. Aldo had neglected to mention all those times he told me to live with him, that his father hated him like I hated my mother. Aldo Sr. had been in World War II, and he'd never forgiven the Japs for all the friends he had lost. "My dad's so full of shit," Aldo said. "He never left Fort Dix." I don't think his father said 4 words to me the whole time I lived with them. He was one mean viejito, and even had a padlock around the refrigerator. "Stay the hell out of it," he told me. We couldn't even get ice cubes out. Aldo and his dad lived in one of the cheapest little bungalows, and me and Aldo slept in a room where his father kept the cat litter for his two cats, and at night we would move it out into the hallway, but he always woke up before us and put it back in the room. "I told you to leave my crap alone," which was funny when you think about it, but it wasn't funny then. I got a job selling French fries on the boardwalk, and between the hot oil and the cat piss, I couldn't smell anything else. On my days off, I would drink with Aldo, or I would sit in the sand, dressed in all black, and try to write in my journal, which I was sure would form the foundation for our utopian society after we blew ourselves into radioactive kibble. Sometimes other boys would walk up to me and would throw lines at me like, "Who fucking died? What's with your hair?" They would sit down next to me in the sand. "You a good-looking girl. You should be in a bikini." "Why? So you can rape me?" "Jesus Christ," one of them said, jumping to his feet. "What the hell is wrong with you?" To this day, I don't know how I lasted. At the beginning of October, I was laid off from the French Fry Palace. By then, most of the boardwalk was closed up, and I had nothing to do except hang out at the public library, which was even smaller than my high school one. Aldo had moved on to working with his dad in his garage, which only made them more pissed at each other, and by extension, more pissed off at me. When they got home, they would drink Schlitz and complain about the Phillies. I guess I should count myself lucky that they didn't just decide to bury the hatchet by gangbanging me. I stayed out as much as I could, and waited for the feelings to come back to me, to tell me what I should do next. But I was bone dry, bereft, no visions whatsoever. I started to think that maybe it was like in the books. As soon as I lost my virginity, I lost my power. I got really mad at Aldo after that. "You're a drunk," I told him. "And an idiot." "So what?" he shot back. "Your pussy smells. Then stay out of it." "I will." But of course, I was happy. Happy. I kept waiting to run into my family posting up flyers of me on the boardwalk. My mom, the tallest, blackest, chestiest thing in sight. Oscar looking like the brown blob. My tía Rubelka. Maybe even my tío if they could get him off the heroin long enough. But the closest I came to any of that was some flyers someone had put up for a cat they lost. That's white people for you. They lose a cat, and it's an all-points bulletin. But we Dominicans, we lose a daughter, and we might not even cancel our appointment at the salon. By November, I was so finished. I would sit there with Aldo and his putrid father, and the old shows would come on the TV. The ones me and my brother used to watch when we were kids. Three's Company, What's Happening, The Jeffersons. And my disappointment would grind against some organ that was very soft and tender. It was starting to get cold, too. And the wind just walked right into the bungalow and got under your blankets or jumped in the shower with you. It was awful. I kept having these stupid visions of my brother trying to cook for himself. Don't ask me why. I was the one who cooked for us. The only thing Oscar knew how to make was grilled cheese. I imagined him thin as a reed, wandering around the kitchen, opening cabinets forlornly. I even started dreaming about my mother, except in my dreams she was a little girl. And I mean really little. I could hold her in the palm of my hand, and she was always trying to say something. I would put her right up to my ear, and I still couldn't hear. I always hated obvious dreams like that. I still do. And then Aldo decided to be cute. I knew he was getting unhappy with us, but I didn't know exactly how bad it was until one night he had his friends over. His father had gone to Atlantic City, and they were all drinking and smoking and telling dumb jokes. And suddenly Aldo says, "Do you know what Pontiac stands for? Poor old nigger thinks it's a Cadillac." But who was he looking at when he told his punchline? He was looking straight at me. That night he wanted me, but I pushed his hand away. "Don't touch me." "Don't get sore," he said, putting my hand on his cock. It wasn't nothing. And then he laughed. So what did I do a couple days later? A really dumb thing. I called home. The first time, no one answered. The second time, it was Oscar. The De Leon residence, how may I direct your call? That was my brother for you. This is why everybody in the world hated his guts. It's me, dumbass. Lola. He was so quiet. And then I realized he was crying. Where are you? You don't want to know. I switched ears, trying to keep my voice casual. How is everybody? Lola, mommy's going to kill you. Dumbass, could you keep your voice down? Mommy isn't home, is she? She's working. What a surprise, I said. Mommy working. On the last minute of the last hour of the last day, my mother would be at work. She would be at work when the missiles were in the air. I guess I must have missed him real bad, or I just wanted to see somebody who knew anything about me, or the cat piss had damaged my common sense, because I gave him the address of a coffee shop on the boardwalk and told him to bring some of my clothes and some of my books. Bring me money, too. He paused. I don't know where mommy keeps it. You know, mister, just bring it. How much? He asked timidly. All of it. That's a lot of money, Lola. Just bring me the money, Oscar. Okay, okay. He inhaled deeply. Will you at least tell me if you're okay or not? I'm okay, I said. And that was the only point in the conversation where I almost cried. I kept quiet until I could speak again. And then I asked him how he was going to get down here without our mother finding out. You know me, he said weakly. I might be a dork, but I'm a resourceful dork. I should have known not to trust anybody whose favorite books as a child were Encyclopedia Brown. But I wasn't really thinking. I was so looking forward to seeing him. By then I had this plan. I was going to convince my brother to run away with me. My plan was that we would go to Dublin. I had met a bunch of Irish guys on the boardwalk, and they had sold me on their country. I would become a backup singer for U2, and both Bono and the drummer would fall in love with me. And Oscar could become the Dominican James Joyce. I really believed it would happen, too. That's how deluded I was by then. The next day, I walked into the coffee shop, looking brand new. And he was there, with the bag. Oscar, I said, laughing, you're so fat. I know, he said, ashamed. I was worried about you. We embraced for like an hour, and then he started crying. Lola, I'm sorry. It's okay, I said. And that's when I looked up and saw my mother and my tia Rubelka and my tio walk into the shop. Oscar! I screamed. But it was too late. My mother already had me in her hands. She looked so thin and worn, almost like a hag. But she was holding on to me like I was her last nickel, and underneath her red wig, her green eyes were furious. I noticed, absently, that she had dressed up for the occasion. That was typical. Muchacha del diablo, she shrieked. I managed to haul her out of the coffee shop, and when she pulled back her hand to smack me, I broke free. I ran for it. Behind me I could feel her sprawling, hitting the curb hard with a crack, but I wasn't looking back. No, I was running. In elementary school, whenever we had field day, I was always the fastest girl in my grade, took home all the ribbons. They said it wasn't fair because I was so big, but I didn't care. I could even have beat the boys if I wanted to. So there was no way my sick mother, my messed up Theo, and my fat brother were going to catch me. I was going to run as fast as my long legs could carry me. I was going to run down the boardwalk, past Aldo's miserable house, out of Wildwood, out of New Jersey, and I wasn't going to stop. I was going to fly. Anyway, that's how it should have worked out. But I looked back. I couldn't help it. It's not like I didn't know my Bible, all that pillars of salt stuff. But when you're someone's daughter that she raised by herself with no help from nobody, habits die hard. I just wanted to make sure my mom hadn't broken her arm or cracked open her skull. I mean, really, who the hell wants to kill her own mother by accident? That's the only reason I glanced back. She was sprawled on the ground. Her wig had fallen out of reach. Her poor bald head out in the day like something private and shameful. And she was bawling like a lost calf.
Hija! Hija!
And there I was, wanting to run off into my future. It was right then when I needed that feeling to guide me, but it wasn't anywhere in sight. Only me. In the end, I didn't have the ovaries. She was on the ground, bald as a baby, crying, probably a month away from dying. And here I was, her one and only daughter, and there was nothing I could do about it. So I walked back, and when I reached down to help her, she clamped onto me with both hands. That was when I realized she hadn't been crying at all. She'd been faking. Her smile was like a lion's. Ya te tengo, she said, jumping triumphantly to her feet. Te tengo! And that is how I ended up in Santo Domingo. I guess my mother thought it would be harder for me to run away from an island where I knew no one. And in a way, she was right. I'm into my 6th month here, and these days I'm just trying to be philosophical about the whole thing. I wasn't like that at first, but in the end, I had to let it go. It was like the fight between the egg and the rock, my abuela said. No winning. I'm actually going to school, not that it's going to count when I return to Patterson, but it keeps me busy and out of mischief and around people my own age. You don't need to be around us viejos all day, abuela says. I have mixed feelings about the school. For one thing, it's improved my Spanish a lot. The academy is a private school, a Carol Morgan wannabe, filled with people my tío Carlos Moya calls los hijos de mami y papi. And then there's me. If you think it was tough being a goth in Patterson, try being a Dominican York in one of those private schools back in DR. You will never meet bitchier girls in your whole life. They whisper about me to death. Someone else would have had a nervous breakdown. But after Wildwood, I'm not so brittle. I don't let it get to me. And the irony of all ironies? I'm on our school's track team. I joined because my friend Rocio, the scholarship girl from Los Mina, told me I could win a spot on the team on the length of my legs alone. Those are the pins of a winner, she prophesied. Well, she must have known something I didn't, because I'm now our school's top runner in the 400 meters and under. That I have talent at this simple thing never ceases to amaze me. Karen would pass out if she could see me running sprints out behind my school while Coach Cortez screams at us, first in Spanish and then in Catalan. Breathe. 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 I've got like no fat left on me. And the musculature of my legs impresses everyone, even me. I can't wear shorts anymore without causing traffic jams. And the other day when my abuela locked us out of the house, she turned to me in frustration and said, Hija, just kick the door open. That pushed a laugh out of both of us. So much has changed these last months. In my head, my heart. Rocio has me dressing up like a real Dominican girl. She's the one who fixed my hair and who helps me with my makeup. And sometimes when I see myself in mirrors, I don't even know who I am anymore. Not that I'm unhappy or anything. Even if I found a hot air balloon that would whisk me straight to U2's house, I'm not sure I would take it. I'm still not talking to my traitor brother, though. The truth is, I'm even thinking of staying one more year. Abuela doesn't want me to ever leave. I'll miss you, she says so simply it can't be anything but true. And my mom has told me I can stay if I want to, but that I would be welcome at home too. Tia Rubelka tells me she's hanging tough, my mother, that she's back to 2 jobs. They send me a picture of the whole family, and Abuela frames it, and I can't look at them without misting up. My mother's not wearing her fakies in it. She looks so thin, I don't even recognize her. Just know that I would die for you, she told me the last time we talked. And before I could say anything, she hung up. But that's not what I wanted to tell you. It's about that crazy feeling that started this whole mess. The bruja feeling that comes singing out of my bones, that takes hold of me, the way blood seizes cotton. The feeling that tells me that everything in my life is about to change. It's come back. Just the other day, I woke up from all these dreams, and it was there, pulsing inside of me. I imagine this is what it feels like to have a child in you. At first I was scared, because I thought it was telling me to run away again. But every time I looked around our house, every time I saw my abuela, the feeling got stronger, so I knew this was something different. I was dating a boy by then. A sweet morenito by the name of Max Sanchez, whom I had met in Los Mina while visiting Rocío. He's short, but his smile and his snappy dressing make up for a lot. Because I'm from Nueva Yol, he talks about how rich he's going to become, and I try to explain to him that I don't care about that, but he looks at me like I'm crazy. I'm going to get a white Mercedes-Benz, he says. Tú verás. But it's the job he has that I love the best, that got me and him started. In Santo Domingo, two or three theaters often share the same set of reels for a movie. So when the first theater finishes with the first reel, they put it in Max's hands, and he rides his motorcycle like crazy to make it to the second theater. And then he drives back, waits, picks up the second reel, and so on. If he's held up or gets into an accident, the first reel will end, and there will be no second reel, and the people in the audience will throw bottles. So far he's been blessed, he tells me, and kisses his San Miguel medal. Because of me, he brags, one movie becomes three. I'm the man who puts together the pictures. Max is not from la clase alta, as my abuela would describe it, and if any of the stuck-up bitches in school saw us, they would just about die. But I'm fond of him. He holds open doors. He calls me his morena. When he's feeling brave, he touches my arm gently and then pulls back. Anyway, I thought maybe the feeling was about Max, and so one day I let him take us to one of the love motels. He was so excited he almost fell off the bed, and the first thing he wanted was to look at my ass. I never knew my big ass could be such a star attraction. But he kissed it 4-5 times, gave me goosebumps with his breath, and pronounced it a tesoro. When we were done, and he was in the bathroom washing himself, I stood in front of the mirror naked and looked at my culo for the first time. A tesoro, I repeated. A treasure. Well? Rocío asked at school, and I nodded once, quickly. And she grabbed me and laughed, and all the girls I hated turned to look, but what could they do? Happiness, when it comes, is stronger than all the jerk girls in Santo Domingo combined. But I was still confused, because the feeling, it just kept getting stronger and stronger, wouldn't let me sleep, wouldn't give me any peace. I started losing races, which was something I never did. You ain't so great, are you, gringa? The girls on the other teams hissed at me, and I could only hang my head. Coach Cortez was so unhappy he just locked himself in his car and wouldn't say anything to any of us. The whole thing was driving me crazy, and then one night I came home from being out with Max. He had taken me for a walk along the malecón. He never had money for anything else. And we had watched the bats zigzagging over the palms and an old ship head into the distance. He talked quietly about moving to the U.S. while I stretched my hamstrings. My abuela was waiting for me at the living room table. Even though she still wears black to mourn the husband she lost when she was young, she's one of the most handsome women I've ever known. We have the same jagged lightning bolt part. And the first time I saw her at the airport, I didn't want to admit it, but I knew that things were going to be okay between us. She stood like she was her own best thing, and when she saw me, she said, Hija, I have waited for you since the day you left. And then she hugged me and kissed me and said, I'm your abuela, but you can call me La Inca. Standing over her that night, her part like a crack in her hair, I felt a surge of tenderness. I put my arms around her, and that was when I noticed that she was looking at photos. Old photos, the kind I'd never seen in my house. Photos of my mother when she was young, and of other people. I picked one up. Mommy was standing in front of a Chinese restaurant. Even with the apron on, she looked potent, like someone who was going to be someone. She was very guapa, I said casually. Abuela snorted. Guapa soy yo. Your mother was a diosa. But so cabeza dura. When she was your age, we never got along. I didn't know that, I said. She was cabeza dura, and I was exigente. But it all turned out for the best, she sighed. We have you and your brother, and that's more than anyone could have hoped for, given what came before. She plucked out one photo. This is your mother's father. She offered me the photo. He was my cousin, and she was about to say something else, and then she stopped. And that's when it hit with the force of a hurricane. The feeling. I stood straight up, the way my mother always wanted me to stand up. My abuela was sitting there, forlorn, trying to cobble together the right words, and I could not move or breathe. I felt like I always did at the last seconds of a race, when I was sure that I was going to explode. She was about to say something, and I was waiting for whatever she was going to tell me. I was waiting to begin.
Chapter 3 The Three Heartbreaks of Belicia Cabral 1955 to 1962 Look at the princess. Before there was an American story, before Patterson spread before Oscar and Lola like a dream, where the trumpets from the island of our eviction had even sounded, there was their mother, Hipatia Belicia Cabral. A girl so tall your leg bones ached just looking at her. So dark, it was as if the creatrix had in her making blinked, who, like her yet-to-be-born daughter, would come to exhibit a particularly Jersey malaise, the inextinguishable longing for elsewheres. Under the Sea. She lived in those days in Bani. Not the frenzied Bani of right now, supported by an endless supply of doyos, who've laid claim to most of Boston, Providence, New Hampshire. This was the lovely Bani of times past, beautiful and respectful. A city famed for its resistance to blackness. And it was here, alas, that the darkest character in our story resided. On one of the main streets near the Central Plaza, in a house that no longer stands. It was here that Belly lived with her mother aunt, if not exactly content, then certainly in a state of relative tranquility. From 1951 on, hija and madre, running their famous bakery near the Plaza Central and keeping their fading, airless house in tip-top shape. Before 1951, our orphaned girl had lived with another foster family, monstrous people, if the rumors are to be believed, a dark period of her life, neither she nor her madre ever referenced. Their very own Página en Blanco. These were the beautiful days, when La Inca would recount for Belly her family's illustrious history while they pounded and wrung dough with bare hands. Your father, your mother, your sisters, your house. Or when the only talk between them was the voices on Carlos Moya's radio and the sound of the butter being applied to Belly's ruined back. Days of mangoes, days of bread. There are not many surviving photos from that period, but it's not hard to imagine them, arrayed in front of their immaculate house in Los Pescadores. Not touching, because it was not their way. Respectability so dense in La Grande that you'd need a blowtorch to cut it. And a guardedness so Minas Tirith in La Pequeña that you'd need the whole of Mordor to overcome it. Theirs was the life of the good people of Sur. Church twice a week, and on Fridays, a stroll through Baní's Parque Central, where in those nostalgic Trujillo days, stick-up kids were nowhere to be seen, and the beautiful bands did play. They shared the same sagging bed, and in the morning, while La Inca fished around blindly for her chancletas, Belly would shiver out to the front of the house, and while La Inca brewed her coffee, Belly would lean against the fence and stare. At what? The neighbors? The rising dust? At the world? Hija, La Inca would call. Hija, come here! 4, 5 times, until finally La Inca walked over to fetch her, and only then did Belly come. Why are you shouting? Belly wanted to know, annoyed. La Inca pushing her back toward the house. Will you listen to this girl? Thinks herself a person when she's not. Belly, clearly. One of those oyasos, always turning, allergic to tranquilidad. Almost any other third-world girl would have thanked Dios Santísimo for the blessed life she led. After all, she had a madre who didn't beat her, who, out of guilt or inclination, spoiled her rotten, bought her flash clothes and paid her bakery wages. Peanuts, I'll admit, but that's more than what 99% of other kids in similar situations earned, which was Nathan. Our girl had it made, and yet it did not feel so in her heart. For reasons she only dimly understood by the time of our narrative, Belly could no longer abide working at the bakery, or being the daughter of one of the most upstanding women in Baní. She could not abide, period. Everything about her present life irked her. She wanted, with all her heart, something else. When this dissatisfaction entered her heart, she could not recall. Would later tell her daughter that it had been with her all her life. But who knows if this is true? What exactly it was she wanted was never clear either. Her own incredible life, yes. A handsome, wealthy husband, yes. Beautiful children, yes. A woman's body, without question. If I had to put it to words, I'd say what she wanted, more than anything, was what she'd always wanted throughout her lost childhood. To escape. From what was easy to enumerate? The bakery, her school, dull-ass Baní, sharing a bed with her madre, the inability to buy the dresses she wanted, having to wait until 15 to straighten her hair, the impossible expectations of La Inca, the fact that her long-gone parents had died when she was one, the whispers that Trujillo had done it, those first years of her life when she'd been an orphan, the horrible scars from that time, her own despised black skin. But where she wanted to escape to, she could not tell you. I guess it wouldn't have mattered if she'd been a princess in a high castle, or if her dead parents' former estate, the glorious Casa Atuey, had been miraculously restored from Trujillo's Omega effect. She would have wanted out. Every morning the same routine. Ipatia Belicia Cabral, ven acá! You ven acá, Belly muttered under her breath. You. Belly had the inchoate longings of nearly every adolescent escapist, of an entire generation, but I ask you, so fucking what? No amount of wishful thinking was changing the cold, hard fact that she was a teenage girl living in the Dominican Republic of Rafael Leónidas Trujillo Molina. The dictatingest dictator who ever dictated. This was a country, a society, that had been designed to be virtually escape-proof. Alcatraz of the Antilles. There weren't any Houdini holes in that plátano curtain. Options are rare as taínos, and for irascible, dark-skinned flacas of modest means, they were rarer still. If you want to cast her restlessness in a broader light, she was suffering the same suffocation that was asphyxiating a whole generation of young Dominicans. 20-odd years of the Trujillato had guaranteed that. Hers was the generation that would launch the revolution, but which for the moment was turning blue for want of air. The generation reaching consciousness in a society that lacked any. The generation that, despite the consensus that declared change impossible, hankered for change all the same. At the end of her life, when she was being eaten alive by cancer, Belly would talk about how trapped they all felt. It was like being at the bottom of an ocean, she said. There was no light, and a whole ocean crushing down on you. But most people had gotten so used to it, they thought it normal. They forgot even that there was world above. But what could she do? Belly was a girl, for fuck's sake. She had no power or beauty yet, or talent or family that could help her transcend. Only La Inca. And La Inca wasn't about to help our girl escape anything. On the contrary, mon frère, La Inca, with her stiff skirts and imperious airs, had as her central goal the planting of Belicia in the provincial soil of Bani, and in the inescapable fact of her family's glorious golden past. The family Belli had never known, whom she had lost early. Remember, your father was a doctor. A doctor. And your mother was a nurse. A nurse. La Inca expected Belli to be the last best hope of her decimated family, expected her to play the key role in a historical rescue mission. But what did she know about her family, except the stories she was told ad nauseam? And ultimately, what did she care? She wasn't a maldita ciguapa, with her feet pointing backward in the past. Her feet pointed forward, she reminded La Inca over and over. Pointed to the future. Your father was a doctor, La Inca repeated unperturbed. Your mother was a nurse. They owned the biggest house in La Vega. Belly did not listen. But at night, when the Alice winds blew in, our girl would groan in her sleep. La chica de mi escuela. When Belly was 13, La Inca landed her a scholarship at El Redentor, one of the best schools in Bani. On paper, it was a pretty solid move. Orphan or not, Belly was the third and final daughter of one of the Siwao's finest families, and a proper education was not only her due, it was her birthright. La Inca also hoped to take some of the heat off Belly's restlessness. A new school with the best people in the valley, she thought. What couldn't this cure? But despite the girl's admirable lineage, Belly herself had not grown up in her parents' upper-class milieu. Had had no kind of breeding until La Inca, her father's favorite cousin, had finally managed to track her down, rescue her really, and brought her out of the darkness of those days and into the light of Bani. In these last 7 years, meticulous, punctilious La Inca had undone a lot of the damage that life in Outer Asua had inflicted. But the girl was still crazy rough around the edges. Had all the upper-class arrogance you could want, but she also had the mouth of a colmado superstar. Would chew anybody out for anything. Her years in Outer Asua to blame. Putting her dark-skinned, media campesina ass in a Tony school, where the majority of the pupils were the white-skinned children of the regime's tap ladronazos, turned out to be a better idea in theory than in practice. Brilliant doctor father or not, Belly stood out in El Redentor. Given the delicacy of the situation, another girl might have adjusted the polarity of her persona to better fit in, would have kept her head down, and survived by ignoring the 10,001 barbs directed at her each day by students and staff alike. Not Beli. She never would admit it, even to herself, but she felt utterly exposed at El Redentor. All those pale eyes gnawing at her duskiness like locusts, and she didn't know how to handle such vulnerability. Did what had always saved her in the past. Was defensive and aggressive and mad overreactive. You said something slightly off-color about her shoes, and she brought up the fact that you had a slow eye and danced like a goat with a rock stuck in its ass. Ouch. You would just be playing and homegirl would be coming down on you off the top rope. Let's just say, by the end of her second quarter, Beli could walk down the hall without fear that anyone would crack on her. The downside of this, of course, was that she was completely alone. It wasn't like in the time of the butterflies, where a kindly Mirabal sister steps up and befriends the poor scholarship student. No Miranda here. Everybody shunned her. The Mirabal sisters were the great martyrs of that period. Patria Mercedes, Minerva Argentina, and Antonia Maria, three beautiful sisters from Salcedo, who resisted Trujillo and were murdered for it. One of the main reasons why the women from Salcedo have reputations for being so incredibly fierce, don't take shit from nobody, not even a Trujillo. Their murders and the subsequent public outcry are believed by many to have signaled the official beginning of the end of the Trujillato, the tipping point, when folks finally decided enough was enough. Despite the outsized expectations Beli had had on her first days to be number one in her class and to be crowned prom queen opposite handsome Jack Pujols, Beli quickly found herself exiled beyond the bone walls of the macroverse itself, flung there by the ritual of Chud. She wasn't even lucky enough to be demoted into that lamentable subset, those mega losers that even the losers pick on. She was beyond that, in Sycorax territory. Her fellow Ultra Dalits included the boy in the iron lung, whose servants would wheel him into the corner of the class every morning and who always seemed to be smiling, the idiot. And the Chinese girl, whose father owned the largest pulperia in the country and was known, dubiously, as Trujillo's Chino. In her 2 years at El Redentor, Wei never managed to learn more than a gloss of Spanish. Yet, despite this obvious impediment, she reported dutifully to class every day. In the beginning, the other students had scourged her with all the usual anti-Asian nonsense. They cracked on her hair, it's so greasy, on her eyes, can you really see through those? On chopsticks, I got some twigs for you, on language, variations on Ching Chongese. The boys especially loved to tug their faces back into bucked-tooth, chinky-eyed rictuses. Charming, ha-ha, jokes aplenty. But once the novelty wore off, she didn't ever respond. The students exiled Wei to the Phantom Zone, and even the cries of China, China, China died down eventually. This was who Beli sat next to her first 2 years of high school. But even Wei had some choice words for Beli. You black, she said, fingering Belly's thin forearm. Black, black. Beli tried her hardest, but she couldn't spin bomb-grade plutonium from the light-grade uranium of her days. During her lost years, there had been no education of any kind, and that gap had taken a toll on her neural pathways, such that she could never fully concentrate on the material at hand. It was stubbornness and the expectations of La Inca that kept Belicia lashed to the mast, even though she was miserably alone and her grades were even worse than Wei's. You would think, La Inca complained, that you could score higher than a China. The other students bent furiously over their exams, while Beli stared at the hurricane whirl at the back of Jack Pujols' crew cut. Señorita Cabral, are you finished?
No, maestra.
And then, a forced return to the problem sets, as though she were submerging herself in water against her will. No one in her barrio could have imagined how much she hated school. La Inca certainly didn't have a clue.
Colegio El Redentor was about 1,000,000 miles removed from the modest working-class neighborhood where she and La Inca lived. And Belly did everything possible to represent her school as a paradise where she cavorted with the other immortals, a 4-year interval before the final apotheosis. Took on even more airs. Where before La Inca had to correct her on grammar and against using slang, she now had the best diction and locution in Lower Bani.
She's starting to talk like Cervantes,
La Inca bragged to the neighbors.
I told you that school would be worth the trouble. Belly didn't have much in the way of friends. Only Dorca, the daughter of the woman who cleaned for La Inca, who owned exactly no pair of shoes and worshipped the ground Belly walked on. For Dorca, she put on a show to end all shows. She wore her uniform straight through the day until La Inca forced her to take it off.
What do you think, these things were free?
And talked unceasingly about her schoolmates, painting each one as her deepest friend and confidant. Even the girls who made it their mission to ignore and exclude her from everything. 4 girls we will call the Squadron Supreme. Found themselves rehabilitated in her tales as benevolent older spirits that dropped in on Belicia every now and then to give her invaluable advice on the school and life in general. The squadron, it turned out, were all very jealous of her relationship with Jack Pujols, who, she reminded Dorca, is my boyfriend. And, invariably, one member or another of the squadron fell to weakness and attempted to steal her novio. But of course, he always rebuked their treacherous advances.
I am appalled, Jack would say, casting the hussy aside. Especially considering how well Belicia Cabral, daughter of the world-famous surgeon, has treated you.
In every version, after a prolonged period of iciness, the offending squadron member would throw herself at Belly's feet and beg forgiveness, which, after tense deliberation, Belly invariably granted.
They can't help it if they're weak, she explained to Dorca, or that Jack is so guapo.
What a world, she spun. Belly talked of parties and pools and polo games and dinners where bloody steak was heaped onto plates and grapes were as common as tangerines. She, in fact, without knowing, was talking about the life she never knew, the life of Casa Atuay. So astonishing were her descriptions that Dorca often said, I would like to go to school with you one day.
Belly snorted. You must be crazy. You're too stupid.
And Dorca would lower her head, stare at her own broad feet, dusty in their chancletas. La Inca talked about Belly becoming a female doctor.
You wouldn't be the first, but you'd be the best.
Imagined her hija raising test tubes up to the light. But Belly usually passed her school days dreaming about the various boys around her. She had stopped staring at them openly after one of her teachers had written a letter home to La Inca, and La Inca had chastised her.
Where do you think you are? A brothel? This is the best school in Bani, muchacha. You're ruining your reputation.
And if not about the boys, then about the house she was convinced she would one day own, furnishing it in her mind room by room by room. Her madre wanted her to bring back Casa Atuay, a history house. But Belly's house was new and crisp, had no history at all attached to it. In her favorite Maria Montes daydream, a dashing European of the Jean-Pierre Aumont variety, who happened to look exactly like Jack Pujols, would catch sight of her in the bakery and fall madly in love with her and sweep her off to a chateau in France. Maria Montes, celebrated Dominican actress, moved to the U.S. and made more than 25 films between 1940 and 1951, including Arabian Nights, Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, Cobra Woman, and my personal favorite, Siren of Atlantis. Crowned the Queen of Technicolor by fans and historians alike. Born Maria Africa Gracia Vidal on June 6, 1912, in Barahona, bit her screen name from the famous 19th-century courtesan Lola Montes. herself famous for fucking, among others, the part Haitian Alexandre Dumas. Maria Montes was the original J-Lo. Or whatever smoking caribeña is the number one eye crack of your time. The first real international star the DR had. Ended up marrying a Frenchie, sorry Anacaona, and moving to Paris after World War II. Drowned alone in her bathtub at the age of 39. No sign of struggle, no evidence of foul play. Did some photo ops for the Trujillato every now and then, but nothing serious. It should be pointed out that while in France, Maria proved to be quite the nerd. Wrote 3 books. 2 were published. The 3rd manuscript was lost after her death.
Wake up, girl. You're going to burn the pan de agua.
Belly wasn't the only girl dreaming like this. This jeringonza was in the air. It was the dream shit that they fed girls day and night. It's surprising Belly could think of anything else. What with that heavy rotation of boleros, canciones, and versos spinning in her head, with the Listín Diario Society pages spread before her. Belly at 13 believed in love like a 70-year-old widow who's been abandoned by family, husband, children, and fortune, believes in God. Belicia was, if it was possible, even more susceptible to the Casanova wave than many of her peers. Our girl was straight boy crazy. To be called boy crazy in Santo Domingo is a singular distinction. It means that you can sustain infatuations that would reduce your average North Americana to cinders. She stared at the young bravos on the bus, secretly kissed the bread of the buen mozos who frequented the bakery, sang to herself all those beautiful Cuban love songs. God save your soul, La Inca grumbled, if you think boys are an answer to anything. But even the boy situation left a lot to be desired. If she'd been interested in the niggers in the barrio, our Belly would have had no problems. These cats would have obliged her romantic spirit by jumping her lickety-split. But alas, La Inca's hope that the rarefied private airs of Colegio El Redentor would have a salutary effect on the girl's character, like a dozen wet belt beatings or 3 months in an unheated convent, had at least in this one aspect borne fruit. For Belly, at 13, only had eyes for the Jack Pujolses of the world. As is usually the case in these situations, the high-class boys she so desired didn't reciprocate her interest. Belly didn't have quite enough of anything to snap these rubirosas out of their rich girl reveries. What a life. Each day turning on its axis slower than a year. She endured school, the bakery, La Inca's suffocating solicitude with a furious jaw. She watched hungrily for visitors from out of town, threw open her arms at the slightest hint of a wind, and at night she struggled Jacob-like against the ocean pressing down on her. Kimota. So what happened? A boy happened. Her first. Numero uno. Jack Pujols, of course. The school's handsomest, reed whitest, boy. A haughty, slender Melnibonian of pure European stock, whose cheeks looked like they'd been napped by a master, and whose skin was unflawed by scar, mole, blemish, or hair. His small nipples were the pink perfect ovals of sliced salchicha. His father was a colonel in the Trujillato's beloved Air Force, a heavy-duty player in Bani, would be instrumental in bombing the capital during the revolution, killing all those helpless civilians, including my poor uncle Benicio. And his mother, a former beauty queen of Venezuelan proportions, now active in the church, a kisser of cardinal rings and a socorro of orphans. Jack, eldest son, privileged seed, hijo bello, anointed one, revered by his female family members, and that endless monsoon rain of praise and indulgence had quickened in him the bamboo of entitlement. He had the physical swagger of a boy twice his size, and an unbearable loud-mouthed cockiness that he drove into people like a metal spur. In the future, he would throw his lot in with the demon Balaguer and end up ambassador to Panama as his reward. But for the moment, he was the school's Apollo, its Mithra. The teachers, the staff, the girls, the boys, all threw petals of adoration beneath his finely arched feet. He was proof positive that God, the great God absolute, the center and circumference of all democracy, does not love his children equally. Although not essential to our tale per se, Balaguer is essential to the Dominican one. So therefore, we must mention him, even though I'd rather piss in his face. The elders say, anything uttered for the first time summons a demon. And when 20th century Dominicans first uttered the word freedom en masse, the demon they summoned was Balaguer. Known also as the election thief. See the 1966 election in the DR, and the homunculus. In the days of the Trujillato, Balaguer was just one of El Jefe's most efficient ringwraiths. Much is made of his intelligence. He certainly impressed the failed cattle thief, and of his asceticism. When he raped his little girls, he kept it real quiet. After Trujillo's death, he would take over Project Domo and rule the country from 1960 to 1962, from 1966 to 1978, and again from 1986 to 1996. By then, dude was blind as a bat, a living mummy. During the second period of his rule, known locally as the 12 years, he unleashed a wave of violence against the Dominican left, death squatting hundreds and driving thousands more out of the country. It was he who oversaw slash initiated the thing we call diaspora. Considered our national genius, Joaquin Balaguer was a negrophobe, an apologist to genocide, an election thief, and a killer of people who wrote better than himself, famously ordering the death of journalist Orlando Martinez. Later, when he wrote his memoirs, he claimed he knew who had done the foul deed, not him, of course, and left a blank page, a página en blanco in the text to be filled in with the truth upon his death. Can you say impunity? Balaguer died in 2002. The página es still blanca. Appeared as a sympathetic character in Vargas Llosa's The Feast of the Goat. Like most homunculi, he did not marry and left no heirs. And how did Belly interact with Jack Pujols, this insane object of attraction? In a way that is fitting of her bullheaded directness. She would march down the hallway, books pressed to her pubescent chest, staring down at her feet and pretending not to see him, would smash into his hallowed vessel.
Caramba!
He spluttered, wheeling about, and then he'd see it was Belicia, a girl, now stooping over to recover her books, and he bent over too. He was, if nothing, a caballero, his anger diffusing, becoming confusion, irritation.
Caramba, Cabral! What are you, a bat? Watch where you're going.
He had a single worry line creasing his high forehead, his part, as it became known. And eyes of the deepest cerulean. The eyes of Atlantis. Once Belly had overheard him bragging to one of his many female admirers. Oh, these old things? I inherited them from my German abuela.
Come on, Cabral. What's your difficulty?
It's your fault, she swore, meant in more ways than one. Maybe she'd see better, one of his lieutenants cracked. If it was dark out. It might as well have been dark out. For all intents and purposes, she was invisible to him. And would have stayed invisible, too, if the summer of sophomore year she'd not hit the biochemical jackpot, not experienced a summer of her secondary sex characteristics, not been transformed utterly. A terrible beauty has been born. Where before Belly had been a gangly ibis of a girl, pretty in a typical sort of way, by summer's end, she'd become un mujerón total, acquiring that body of hers, that body that made her famous.